pasture. You're coming home, you're coming home. Every night the tears come down from my eyes. Every day I've done nothing but cry.
Was that the mono version that we're listening to?
It was, Richard. It was the mono version.
Why not the stereo?
Because this was Beatles as nature intended.
Oh, I see. Although, wasn't it in the States with much more reverb?
What? Yeah, that stuff came along later when Capitol started putting out their bastardizations. But, you know, for the currency for the fans in 63, 64 was mono. And it really would stay that way until the 70s when Apple started reissuing the things. And that was really when the stereo started getting the widespread attention and notice that it hadn't to that point.
By the way, folks, I'm Richard Buskin.
And this is Robert Rodriguez.
And we're talking about It Won't Be Long, which was the opening track on the Beatles' second album with the Beatles.
Right.
Which was released.
Not the Beatles' second album on Capitol. That came along later.
No. Those don't
He didn't know what he was
anyway.
Talking about. They didn't have that number.
Yeah, only the English ones count. But.
Right.
But that was released on November the 22nd, 1963, the day of President Kennedy's assassination.
Yes, it was. And that's a whole other topic we can talk about in terms of the context of what was going on in the Beatles' career, because in America, this was something that I don't think was generally known because other things happened that day that kind of took over the news cycle. But CBS ran a piece on the Beatles on their morning news that day. And it was supposed to be a longer piece later on in the evening, but it got, of course, overshadowed. But that was really their first meaningful exposure on American TV, the very day that President Kennedy was in Dallas. And
but by the way, folks, if you hear a bit of a frog in Robert's throat, it's because he's got a cold, so he's not trying to do his Harry Nilsson Pussycats impression.
Right, not unlike John and Paul on the Please Please Me album.
Oh, very good.
Yeah, you like that.
Yeah, absolutely. So what we're going to talk about actually is the music on with the Beatles, because it was such a huge advance over the preceding album, which had been recorded only a few months earlier.
Yes, in a single day, and they got a lot more time to work on this one and really develop their craft in the studio. You hear a lot more of the George Martin piano contributions. You know, things are a lot more arranged, and it's less straight-up beat group-sounding things, like you've got the odd percussion on George Harrison's first recorded composition, Don't Bother Me.
Yeah, and it's just a very vibrant sound, isn't it? It's I think it hasn't really dated nearly as much as the Please Please Me album.
No.
The backing vocals on the first album, by today's standards, pretty corny.
Yeah, yeah, you know, it was a reflection of their stage act at the time. And, you know, this was their, you know, Please Please Me, their first big break in terms of getting to record an album-length statement, you know, such as it was, a collection of songs comprising their stage set. By the time With the Beatles started to be recorded in the fall of 63, you know, you've got a band that's really not quite on top of the world, but on their way. You know, you had the Please Please Me success of that album, number one for half the year in England. The single Please Please Me, From Me to You and She Loves You, both chart toppers. So here's a band full of confidence, working their asses off, but they know who they are and what they're capable of. And as John would say later, believing we're the greatest band in the world was what made it happen.
He also said later, if I recall, that we almost double-tracked ourselves off that album. That was the new thing, wasn't it?
Yeah, and production was something that they were slowly getting acclimated to, what you can do in the studio that you couldn't do live, and just ways you can really optimize your sound. You know, double-tracking guitar parts, you know, tracking bass and piano, or bass and guitar in sync to fatten up the sound, and what they were doing with the vocals.
Yeah, and It Won't Be Long was a fantastic way to start the album, because the freshness and the energy of that album is encompassed in that track. It just gets it off to a dynamite start.
Yeah, it just grabs you immediately. And I think John said later that was a song that they wrote kind of thinking it might be a single and wasn't quite, you know, achieving that goal, but it was fine as an album opener.
And at this point, Lennon and McCartney are still writing together.
Yes.
And
on the fly, as it were. You know, tour buses, hotel rooms.
Yeah, back of the van.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
And George, I think, carped later on, amongst many things he carped about, that he,
meow,
you know, didn't get, you know, credit for his contributions to the songs, where he would obviously come up with the guitar solos and various other elements.
Oh, a lot of times the guitar motifs, the riffs that the songs hung on, came straight from him.
Yeah.
And yeah, and that was something that would go for the Beatles' entire career. And only in more recent years, where they're starting to examine George's, you know, life and role, like the Scorsese documentary, you know, Paul reveals that the "And I Love Her" riff that the whole song hinges on came from George. You know, Tom Petty tells a story of he was in the car with George and they were listening to the radio, and "You Can't Do That" came on the radio. And that whole, George points at the speaker and goes, "That was me. You know, I came up with that." And, you know, that's just an invaluable aspect of what the four of them contributed to the greater whole. You know, John and Paul can come up with these great songs, but it really took a George and Ringo, all of them pushing forward equally and on the same page, to elevate them to the status that we regard them as tonight.
I think this is also a point where, if you look at the chronology of how the songs were written and recorded, or when they were written and recorded, that you begin to get a sense of the competitive edge between John and Paul, and how that really elevated their whole songwriting partnership. You know, basically, if John wrote a song that was, you know, one of his better compositions, Paul would respond in kind.
Yes, that how they raised each other's game. I think they were still pretty much connected at the hip at that point. I mean, you know, one person might come up with the idea of a song, as they always had, and then the other would equally chime in to finish it off and, you know, bring it up to standard. But you see it more increasingly going forward with the Hard Day's Night album that followed and the Beatles for Sale, how the paths were diverging. They were finding their own individual voices, and, you know, one would do something that the other thought was great, and that would then give them cause to respond with something great of their own, and it would just go back and forth like that.
Next, we're going to play a track that I personally think was Paul's first great composition.
I can guess.
"All My Loving."
Yes.
Yeah, and I mean, your view on that?
Great song. Great song.
Mm. And a great recording as well. Just such a smooth recording, isn't it?
And it's another one of those things where every member of the band had something to bring to elevate that song. Mm-hmm. You know, George's superb sort of rockabilly style guitar solo, and then you have John just, you know, chugging away on that rhythm.
Well, he's playing the triplets,
yeah,
basically.
Yeah, which is why he's not singing the background on it, because he's like concentrating on his guitar part.
Yes.
And Ringo kind of swings it. It's interesting to me because a couple years ago when the remasters came out in 2010, and we were doing this studio recording equipment style, you know, sort of a Pepsi challenge, listening to, you know, various iterations of these things, and we were listening to the remasters, and I kept wanting to hear that doom doom, you know, that walking bass line Paul does in the song, and I started questioning whether was I not hearing it because it was never there on the record, or was I kind of conflating it with, you know, the Ed Sullivan Show mix that's the first song they played, and the mix is different. You hear the bass a lot more up front. And I was wanting to hear it in the remaster, but I'm thinking, no, it's on the Ed Sullivan Show that I hear that. It was never really that up front on the record. So it's like interesting how these things sort of meld in your mind and you can't separate them.
Well, let's listen to it.
Close your eyes and I'll kiss you. Tomorrow I'll miss you. Pretend that I'm missing the lips I am missing, and hope that my dreams will come true. And then while I'm away, I'll write home every day, and I'll send all my loving to you. All my loving I will send to you. All my loving, darling,
close your eyes and I'll kiss you. Tomorrow I'll miss you. Remember, I'll always be true.
So that was the stereo mix of All My Lovin', and I have to say, I don't know how much of a hardcore you are, stereo versus mono with the Beatles stuff, but for at least the first few albums, I do think that mono was the preferable mix.
Well, it was the mix that they put the effort into. George Martin said to me, a bit of name dropping here, but he told me back in 87 that all of the focus on those early albums was the mono mix. The Beatles might be around for that. They wouldn't even be around for the stereo mixes, and those would often be done in like half hour. They would just put the vocals through one channel and the instruments through the other.
Oh, yes. And it's like you wonder what was going on in their minds as they were listening to those stereo mixes back, thinking, you know, this is good. People are going to like this, hearing the vocals out one side and the backing tracks out the other. I mean, as far as use of stereo goes, it's really unsophisticated. And in the
Mickey Mouse, I think is what you
The early first few albums, so where they were still pretty much doing this beat group stuff, it was less of a critical thing to have the preferred mixes be the mono ones. I mean, they sounded more powerful. There was still that mentality of gearing things toward AM mono radio. But I think by 65, 66, as they're starting to get a little more ambitious in the studio and starting layering these things into the recordings, particularly, you know, come Revolver and Tomorrow Never Knows as an instance where I think that was one of the first tracks that absolutely in stereo blows away the mono mix. You know, there's elements you hear in stereo that you don't hear in the mono mix. And, you know, that's it took them three more years before they really started to, you know, get to the point in record production where that became a critical issue. I know there's some people that prefer the mono mix of Sgt. Pepper over the stereo mix. You know, I, like a lot of people later coming into the Beatles' career after they'd split up, you know, stereo was the currency, and so that was how we were first exposed to them. And back when I got my chance to listen to the mono, I couldn't believe that sloppy edit coming out of Good Morning, Good Morning, going into Sgt. Pepper Reprise, that was the most listened to version in 67, where it's a lot more smooth than the stereo one, just as one example.
Well, another example is on the Hard Day's Night album, If I Fell. The stereo mix makes it sound as if Paul at one point, as if his voice just cracks and disappears. And in fact, it turned out Mark Lewisohn discovered that when he listened to the original session tapes. It's exactly the same take. It was just a bad mix of the stereo. It just sort of basically mixes his vocal out at that point.
Which I thought was a cool thing, having heard it in stereo in the first place and hearing that, you know, that alleged cracked voice. It like humanized them.
Well, yeah, I can't imagine, though, that Paul would have been happy about that.
Probably just, not, but he probably
amazing he hasn't gone back in the studio and reissued.
George?
Yeah. Anyway, that's a subject that's going to be for our next show. We're going to go into a lot more detail about the differences between some of the stereo and mono mixes, because some of them are really quite significant.
Yes, and it's almost a different listening experience to certain songs where they really diverged. But back to With the Beatles.
Yeah.
One of my favorite tracks is Not a Second Time, a John composition showing this really heightened sophistication in his songwriting, you know, moving away from the kind of, you know, the songs with You and Me and I and the title for the singles. You know, now they're really getting a little bit more introspective. I don't know that he was particularly speaking to anything, a personal experience, but it's definitely a little bit more on the adult side of things in terms of content. You know, You Broke My Heart Once, I'm Not Going to Let You Do It Again. I mean, maybe I shouldn't say adult. I mean, teen songs
were
about
actually not the first time, though, that he'd, you know, got introspective. I mean, on Please Please Me, you have There's a Place.
Right.
There's a place where I can go when I feel blue, when I feel low.
And right. I mean, more in a romantic sense where it's not all, you know, the happy, I'm in love with you, she loves me, I feel fine stuff. And again, to give credit where credit is due, you know, George Martin, who recognizes elements he can bring to the table as a musician himself, he has that great, you know, piano interlude in the middle of the song that gives it something beyond just pure what you would hear the Beatles performing on stage. You know, they were into crafting records.
You know you made me cry. I see no use in wondering why. No reason to change my mind. It's through. Oh, you're giving me the same old lie. I'm wondering why you hurt me then. You're back again. No, 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 not a second time.
So that was the decaying notes of Not a Second Time. It was actually the closer on Meet the Beatles in America months later, but in England it was the penultimate track right before Money, which was their closer, sort of the twist and shout of the second album. And anyway, that was the track that drew the notice of William Mann in the Times of London, their music critic, who wasn't really a critic that did much rock and roll stuff, right?
Right. And, you know, this was like serious heavyweight reviewing suddenly for the Beatles, you know, a pop act.
Yeah, I mean, they're riding, you know, this wave of success, you know, with what had happened in October, November, you know, London Palladium, the Royal Variety Show, all this great press they'd been getting, the Beatlemania thing. And now they're starting to draw notice from the quote-unquote intellectual community about their musical sophistication.
Well, they're actually having some of the British politicians refer to them. There are doctors or psychiatrists trying to analyze this phenomenon of Beatlemania. But, you know, some of it is amusing, some of it is plain daft, but really what it was showing was that they were getting taken seriously. They were garnering so much attention at this point.
Yes, and that particular quote where they referred to the Aeolian cadences that the Beatles implemented in that track.
Which, you know, I think John said that the only Aeolian cadence he knew, or what it sounded like to him, was like some kind of exotic bird.
Right. It was giving these guys credit for, you know, sophistication beyond what they actually did possess. But it was cool because, you know, for the first time, you know, rock and roll acts didn't typically get that kind of attention from respected critics like that. So, you know, once again, the Beatles were sort of on the cutting edge of starting to take their genre seriously.
Yeah, because I don't think anyone had known a pop act to be turning out original material like this.
No.
And something I should also point out is, you know, we listened earlier to All My Loving. That was released as a single in the US. That was typical.
Canada.
Was that?
Canada.
Oh, in Canada?
Yeah.
Oh,
I see. Capital of Canada. Yeah.
Oh, right. Okay. But in Britain, you know, that was just one of many, many tracks with single potential that never did see the light of day as a single.
There was that All My Lovin' EP in Britain on Parlophone.
Yeah.
That had, it replicated the album art with the Beatles. But yeah, and it just shows that they had this, all these great songs that they were stocking their albums with that could have been hits on their own.
And then, you know, another thing that the Beatles had shown on the first album, and they really showed off their talent on the second album, was their ability to do fantastic cover versions of other people's material.
Yes.
And, you know, one song that I particularly love, I don't know you think of it, is Devil in Her Heart.
Oh, it's a great one. Great little George showcase.
Yeah, I mean, originally, I mean, it was the year before the Donnays had released it as Devil in His Heart.
Right, one of these girl groups that the Beatles were so adept at taking material originally sung by girls and turning it and making their own. You know, Boys being a great example, that Shirelles track.
Yeah, and also, you know, their introduction of Motown to the UK, Money being, you know, one prime example.
Or You Really Got a Hold on Me, Smokey Robinson being one of their favorite songwriters, and you definitely see his fingerprints on some of the original compositions that came along during that era.
And George never sort of held back on the praise for Smokey Robinson, did he?
No, recording two tributes during the solo years, Pure Smokey and Ooh Baby, You Know I Love You.
Yes.
On Extra Texture and 33 and a Third, respectively.
Yeah.
Speaking of George as a songwriter, you know, he finally, having been, if you look at their BBC recordings, which we'll talk about a little bit later, and some of the stuff they did at the Star Club that exists by those tapes that came out as an album, you know, he was doing a lot more lead vocals in their stage act than he generally was allotted space on the albums. I think largely due to the fact that he hadn't really come into his own as a songwriter quite yet. And so, you know, he would have to take whatever bones John and Paul deemed to throw him. You know, Do You Want to Know a Secret? I'm Happy Just to Dance with You for the first three albums. On this one, you know, he sings the aforementioned Donnay song and Roll Over Beethoven. But he also got to record his very own first composition, Don't Bother Me.
Well, you say his first composition, that is his first kind of officially released composition.
Yeah.
Let's not forget in the Quarrymen years, he also...
Oh, right. You got the co-credit for In Spite of All the Danger.
Yeah, and Cry for a Shadow.
Right, that's true, that's true. And Paul was quick to point out that the only reason he got credit for In Spite of All the Danger at all was because he composed the guitar solo.
Right, very generous.
But it was, yeah, but Maka says, really my song.
Yeah, but anyway, what we're going to listen to now is some of the outtakes of Don't Bother Me.
Yeah, that the Beatles at work in the studio, and you get a sense of how they're, you know, slowly but surely taking command of their own destiny in the studio, you know, sort of arranging things on the fly and, you know, just making better use of just going in there to record what they were doing on stage.
Don't Bother Me, this is remake, we're calling it take 10.
Since she's been gone, I want no one to talk to me. It's not the same, but I'm to blame, it's plain to see. So go away, leave me alone, don't bother me.
Take 11.
Since she's been gone, I want no one to talk to me.
Hang on, it's too going to.
Take 12.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Since she's been gone, I want no one to talk to me. It's not the same, but I'm to blame, it's plain to see. So go away, leave me alone, don't bother me. I can't believe that she would leave me on my own. It's just not right when every night I'm all alone. I've got no time for you right now.
You know, it's time is awful for me, so I'm singing and mine, you know, a note on a
take 13.
Since she's been gone, I want no one to talk to me. It's not the same, but I'm to blame, it's plain to see. So go away, leave me alone, don't bother me. I can't believe that she would leave me on my own. It's just not right when every night I know I'll never be the same.
till she's here. Please don't come near, just stay away. I'll let you know when she's come home. Until that day, don't come around, leave me alone, don't bother me. She's here, please don't come near, just stay away. I let you know when she's come home until that day. Don't come around, leave me alone, don't bother me. Don't bother me. Don't bother me.
So there you go, the Beatles running through Don't Bother Me in the studio, and you see how it sort of evolved over multiple takes, that they had that the little stop early on, and Ringo's throwing in a drum fill, and eventually for the finished version, they just plowed straight through that.
Yeah, I think one of them had like a kind of weird bass twang, you know, started, and then as you say, another one had a nice drum fill from Ringo. You know, it's just typical band stuff, isn't it? You just mix it up every
time.
Yeah,
just figuring it out as you go and what works, what sounds cool. And, you know, it's funny because it sounds so cool and fresh to us now hearing that little drum fill and those breaks. You know, if that had been the version they put out 50 years ago, we'd be thinking, wow, how cool it is. They just went straight through when they played it in the outtake version.
But yeah.
Yeah, it's neat stuff. But, you know, all in all, a really successful, you know, a major advance in their art from the Please Please Me album.
Well, and that's the thing about the Beatles. I mean, was it 12 albums in 7 years?
Yeah.
And every one is different from the, you know, the preceding one, and always a huge leap forward,
yeah,
isn't it?
Moving the goalposts and, you know, getting much better at their craft.
A different sound to each album as well. It's like, you know, I always think of 65, the Help album, for instance, you've got the Hammond organ sound.
Yes.
You get the harmonium sound in the era of Rubber Soul.
Right.
And, you know, every album's got its own sort of sound, basically.
Right,
and
a little ambience. And
yeah.
This is no exception. It, to me, what I listen to and what distinguishes it from what preceded it is just the energy. You know, from that opening cut to, you know, to ending with Money, you know, they sound like a band that is just, you know, bursting with confidence and knows they've got the world in the palm of their hand.
And also enthusiasm.
You
know, there's a real undeniable enthusiasm that runs through that album and carries forward to, you know, Hard Day's Night.
Sure.
You know, not just the album, but the film. You see the, you know, how much they just threw themselves into it.
Yeah, that adrenaline and just that confidence. And, you know, speaking of, you know, just that sense of them enjoying how much they're playing together as a band, you see that or hear it abundantly in the new BBC set.
Oh, nice link. I like how you did that.
It's like a pro, man.
Very good at this. Yes. Yeah. Well, we were bitching about that in the previous episode, weren't we?
We were. That's what we do.
And we've got a lot to bitch about.
Yes. You know, this is the thing, and I think we touched on this a little bit, but, you know, you've got Apple designing these things to try to reach the maximum widest audience, and it's going to be a certain amount of it unfamiliar to the general fan, but they're going to want to hear the hits too, so you're going to get the live versions of things that are very familiar. But the purists, the hardcores, you know, they've been downloading BBC stuff or buying it on vinyl, you know, before that for years and years. So it's going to be tough to really win them over unless you come up with some sort of great sonic upgrade. And I just don't know, given the limitations of what you have to work with, since it's not like they kept the master tapes of this stuff and you have to work with whatever fans taped off the radio. You know, that's just what you're going to have. And, you know, to the extent that you're able to present it in a way that's fresh and engaging with, you know, some of the studio chatter and stuff like that, that's really going to be how successful it's going to be to a hardcore fan.
Yeah, but I think, you know, members of the general public as well would just be interested to hear the Beatles do songs that they never heard them do. So, you know, some of those ones from 62 that we have on bootlegs.
Yes, it would be great. But you might get a segment of them carping, oh, you know, what is this? You know, it sounds like crap. Why are they putting this
out
there?
Well, who cares about the carpers?
Right. And did the Beatles really need to sell 100 million units every time out? You know, they could sell fewer, and putting out something much more valuable, you know, as a service to the fans. You know, if they want to put out a Beatles 2, they could do that and easily sell millions and millions of copies. You know, no Please Please Me on Beatles 1, no Strawberry Fields. You know, that they could, you know, amend that and rectify what I thought was maybe possibly just leaving the door open to do a volume 2 and still sell their million units while putting out this sort of, you know, BBC hardcore product, you know, to sort of clear the vaults and keep the, you know, keep some income from themselves that they're throwing away by allowing the bootleggers to take care of it.
Yeah. As I said before, I'm wondering if some of those 62 BBC recordings haven't been included because they just don't want Pete Best to earn more money.
Well, I don't know what their issues are with Pete, and maybe because he's out on the road these days touring with his own band, and he's got his book out, and you know, maybe they see that he doesn't need Apple anymore to generate an income stream for himself. I don't know.
No one should earn money off the Beatles except the Beatles. That's what they think.
Right. So, what are we going to play?
Beautiful Dreamer.
And they bring their own exciting rhythm and blues type treatment to Beautiful Dreamer.
Okay, so that was Beautiful Dreamer, written by one Stephen Foster back in the 1860s as a romantic ballad at that time, and it's been covered over the years by a whole slew of artists. I know Bing Crosby did a version, Jerry Lee Lewis did a rocked-up version, and although this R&B cover by the Beatles was done in early 63 for Saturday Club.
Yeah, January.
Right. Later that year, Roy Orbison also did a version that was on his In Dreams album.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's my favorite use of that song came in the Twilight Zone. You'll appreciate that. A Stop at Willoughby episode.
Yeah, we're both big fans of the Twilight Zone.
And the sequence has that the main character is hearing it in this performed by a brass band in a gazebo in the 1800s, and it just totally fits what's going on in the plot, which I'm not going to spoil for you now.
Right, well, we digress anyway.
Indulging
our other interests there. But yeah, Beautiful Dreamer was one of the BBC tracks.
It's great because it's not something that, you know, showed up on the Star Club tapes or any of the other BBC recordings or Decca Audition. Just one of these one-off, weird, oddball covers that the Beatles would throw into their live sets, sung by Paul, of course. Speaking of live sets...
Why did you say Paul, of course? Is that a dig?
No, it's not a dig, but he certainly had the most eclectic musical taste.
Yeah, all right. That's our producer getting involved again.
Right. Whenever they would do, you know, something like a show tune, you would know pretty much it's Paul that would be the one taking the vocal on it. But speaking to something that was part of the live act and is on the new set that people have been wanting to hear was the Chuck Berry song Talking About You, which was basically the blueprint, as Paul would admit years later, for I Saw Her Standing There. And that is on the Star Club set as well.
Can you do that again? All right, that's enough. And yeah, that is on, as you say, on the Star Club album. But that's the only, for me personally, and I know a lot of people will hate me for saying this, for me that's the only real track of interest on the new BBC album, because it's, you know, one that we haven't heard them do in a studio setting.
Right, exactly. And that's the kind of stuff that, you know, as a hardcore, that's the kind of stuff you want to hear more of. And, you know, luckily through the various iterations of BBC stuff that have been sort of these underground releases for years, you know, we've already seen what exists. So that gives us the right to kind of carp about what decisions were made, you know, what stuff they're tossing out and what stuff they were holding back.
Listen, this is our show. We've got a right to carp about whatever we want to carp
And we will,
about.
Folks.
Yeah. Okay, here's I'm Talking About You.
That was I'm Talking About You from Chuck Berry, one of their stage songs. And it's interesting that, you know, they did do quite a bit of Chuck Berry in their live sets.
He was a huge influence. I mean, especially as a lyricist.
Oh, yeah, especially. John very much picked up on that. Yeah. What's interesting to me, speaking of Chuck Berry's lyrics, is how John would be sued later on for Come Together for the Here Come Old Flat Top line. And how apparently Chuck's music publishers didn't pick up on I Saw Her Standing There as pretty much a cop on the song we just heard, and they let that one go. It's interesting that they were more attuned to the lyric and borrowings thereof than they were of music per se.
Yeah, of course they had a run-in as well, didn't they, with the Beach Boys?
Yeah, which was pretty flagrant for Surfing USA.
Yeah, Sweet Little 16.
Yeah, which the Beatles also did a hell of a job on, and there was Club Days.
Yeah. But back to the BBC album, you know, there are also repeats of, well, not the same takes, but the same songs that are on the first BBC album. There are several of those on the second one, and I personally don't see the point of doing that. That's filler to me.
It's if you've got the wealth of material to draw from, and there's so many obvious omissions already, I don't know why they would repeat, for instance, I Got a Woman, which I have to say, just as a little sidebar digression here, that was the opening track on a bootleg that came out in the 70s, and I talk about this in my new book, and it was one of these...
What's the name of your new book?
Solo in the 70s.
Where's it available?
It's available at paradingpress.com.
Yay.
Thanks for asking, Richard. There was that bootleg record that came out in the 70s called As Sweet As You Are, sometimes referred to as Yellow Matter Custard. In one iteration, it was called the Decca Audition Tapes, which it wasn't, although it did fool John Lennon, who thought it was, when he played it for Paul in 74.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, when he was in L.A.?
No, in New York, actually, when him and May Pang were living together, and Paul and Linda would drop by, and John would play the bootlegs in his collection for Paul, and apparently he actually thought this was what they recorded at Decca.
How do we know that? Who told that story?
Was May Pang, I believe.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah. But,
and did they both believe it was?
I don't know. Paul probably was probably a little more critical and not just accepting what he was told. And, you know, I mean, the one distinguishing characteristic would have been Pete Best drumming at Decca versus what's clearly Ringo on this album. You know, it's got much more sophistication.
It's fantastic how they just would move on from things. You know, I mean, let's face it, 74, that was only 12 years after the Decca audition, but so much had happened to the Beatles in those 12 years.
They were too busy making history to keep track of it.
Yeah. That's what they rely on people like us for.
Exactly, and we're very good at it. But going back to that album, it started with I Got a Woman and included Glad All Over, not the DC5 song, but the actual Carl Perkins song. That great Anne Margaret cover, I Just Don't Understand. It had Slow Down, which they recorded for EMI. Don't Ever Change, A Shot of Rhythm and Blues, a great Arthur Alexander song. Sure to Fall, another Carl Perkins song that Ringo would re-record for Stop and Smell the Roses. And Nothing Shaken, Leaves on the Trees, Lonesome Tears in My Eyes, which John borrowed from for...
How do you memorize all of this? It's amazing.
It's ingrained in my DNA. Yeah,
as well as on the printed page that you got in front of you.
Yeah, that too. Anyway, it was a great collection of non-original material that showed the diversity, everything from Perkins to Buddy Holly, you know, just and you know, Anne Margaret, you know, this eclecticism in their musical tastes, you know, it's circa 1963, all stuff they recorded for the BBC, and it's been spread out over the two BBC releases, which to me, I think, dilutes its impact. I think as a 12-song collection of tunes, yes, there's no Lennon McCartney, but it really showcases their diversity and their greatness as a performing unit, the four of these guys making such great music together as a band.
It's interesting that at, you know, the end of the Beatles' career, near the end, the Get Back project, which eventually was renamed Let It Be, how they returned to those rock and roll standards when they were jamming in the studio.
Oh my God, yeah. I mean, you listen to any of that Twickenham stuff and it's like, you know,
Twickenham, Robert. No ham. It's Twickenham.
Twickenham, yeah. Okay. Don't get me started on the English language.
I know.
Developed by the people who call themselves English.
Yeah, the ones who invented the language, but never
right.
mind.
But don't adhere to its logical rules.
Get on with it.
Anyway, you know, they spend hours and hours getting down to everything but the business at hand by running through like every song they ever played in their life. And it's amazing how they are able to recall this stuff for the most part. I mean, John couldn't remember his own lyrics half the time, but you know, he can quote you Chuck Berry from 1957.
Right. Yeah, which goes to show you where he estimates the material, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a lot of fun stuff. And that should be a topic for another show, actually. We'll talk about the Beatles covers January 69.
Wait, oh yes, wait a minute, Mr. Postman. Wait, wait, hey, 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 Mr. Postman. Mr. Postman, look and see. Oh, is that a letter in your bag for me?
That was Please, Mr. Postman from the BBC collection. And it actually works out well because it brings to mind our questions from listeners, which didn't come in the form of mail this time, but actual in the tradition of Across the Universe, where the Beatles went out in the street and recruited a couple fans to sing on the backing track. We got a questioner off the street here, and it happens to be Marcy from Reno.
Yes, good afternoon. I was under the impression that a number of these tracks had basically disappeared. Where did they resurface from? Where did the BBC find these tracks again?
Okay, Marcy's asking about the tracks used in the BBC collection. It's true, probably more for BBC television broadcasts, that a lot of the stuff was wiped and had disappeared in the 60s before they really recognized the value of keeping the stuff around. But speaking to the radio broadcast, which they did hundreds of shows or hundreds of performances, basically, it came down to fans who taped the stuff off the radio back in the day.
Which is fantastic because, you know, people didn't have the facilities then that they have now to record, you know. So I imagine it would have been reel-to-reel recorders.
Yeah, and people setting
with
up
a microphone,
set
next to the
and
speaker.
Keeping the room quiet. Although there's one bootleg I've heard where somebody was recording a broadcast and you could hear the people in the room. That's not one that's been released officially. But we kind of know what it's like to have noises going on in the background when you're trying to record something.
Oh, yeah.
It's maddening. But anyway, the BBC recordings, basically, when they got the idea in their heads to put out official iterations of what had been bootlegged for years and years, they actually started reaching out to the fans, you know, what have you got, and did their best to sort of clean the stuff up. Now, a lot of the hardcore fans have complained that what has emerged as bootlegs for the years actually sounds better than the official releases, at least the 1994 BBC release, where they applied some noise reduction to it that sort of shaved off the brightness and kind of compressed things a bit. I do think they did it better this time, don't you?
Yeah, I do. I think that the tracks actually jump much better this time. The ones on the 94 album, some of them sounded pretty muted.
Yeah, and I haven't heard they are remastering the 94 version as part of this current package, but the idea is that they're rectifying what went bad the first time.
Yeah. So, I mean, there are benefits, definitely. I mean, listen, I'd rather they release stuff than they don't release it at all. So,
yes.
But then again, you know, it's just a shame that I think they could have done a much better job of this. And I can't see where they could go with a third album of BBC. I don't know if there'd be the interest from the public. And how much padding would they have to do if they were going to put out the tracks that we've been talking about, which are maybe a half dozen tracks?
Right.
You know, then what do they do? So it looks like they've made a kind of fatal mistake here.
Well, the thought had occurred to me that if they wanted to cull all the interview segments, and I don't know how much time it would add up to, but just that, not the music, and put together something like a freestanding release of just BBC interviews, it might be a nice tie-in with that new BBC book that just came out.
Yeah. So anyway, we're going to tie up this show with the theme song that you actually hear at the beginning, which is by a group called the Corgis.
Yes. And once again, I talk about this in the new book, Solo in the 70s, but they were sort of a spinoff of a group called Stackridge, which was a sort of art rock English band of the early 70s. They did a handful of albums. I think they did about 5 records total in the 70s in England, and never got any traction here. Their third album was produced by George Martin. And Andy Cresswell Davis from Stackridge actually played on the Imagine album. So there's that Beatle connection
there. And Corgis is actually spelt, by the way, with a K. It's K-O-R-G-I-S.
Yes.
They had a couple of hits at the tail end of the 70s, beginning of the 1980s. I remember in the UK they had a big hit with If I Had You, which is a kind of Beatle-ish sounding record.
Yeah, they were very definitely pop rockers.
Yeah, I mean, lead vocalist though doesn't sound very Beatle-ish. I mean, it's very high pitched. And then their next big hit was Everybody's Gotta Learn Sometime, which I think was top 20 in the US.
Yeah, it got some spins here, and that's pretty much anything, the only record at all people would know them for in America.
Yeah,
I think it got covered quite a bit too.
So what do you know about our theme tune?
Something about the Beatles actually was like a postscript. It came along in 2006, and it was this sort of one-off reunion thing that they did, and I had never heard it, and I don't know how big a hit it was in England, but it was a DJ in Canada that interviewed me one time, Renee Young, that turned me on to it, and I thought, well, you know, someday when I have a podcast, that's going to be my theme. And that's how it worked out. So we're going to play the record in its entirety for the only time on this show, and you'll get the sense of where the whole thing came from.
And we'll see you next time.
Take care.